Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Carol Echocher from currently in lockdown London, and you're lucky enough to be listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Carol Echocher is the mother of the magnificent Charlie Echocher, who is the man who is often a guest here on the Tennis Podcast, or who has been over the last few years. We miss Charlie, don't we, Catherine?
Yes, I actually just minutes ago wandered past the spot in the lobby of the hotel I'm staying in, attached to the O2 Arena, where we recorded with Charlie a podcast here last year with many beers. And it was a happy memory laden with pathos.
And yeah, that was why I picked Carol to be our intro today, because that was after a brilliant Dominic Thiem performance that we did that podcast with Charlie.
Was that after the Thiem Djokovic?
It was, yes. So it felt appropriate for some Echocher. Oh, well,
fantastic.
He's not just a pretty face, David.
No, that's well thought through, Matt. I mean, I can't believe that you've actually got stats according to the intros of the mothers of the contributor of a year ago, which is amazing. But anyway, thank you very much, Carol, for your support.
Hello, Carol.
Who's another one of our wonderful backers who has helped the Tennis Podcast continue to grow and hopefully improve over the last 12 months. And we will be running our Kickstarter again from December the 1st. So there'll be more shout-outs and intros that you can get involved in if you'd like to intro a show as well. We've got new categories. We've got some new pet mascot categories, because Catherine Whittaker has not got enough of those this year. So we've got some more. We've invented some more. We've got some more predictions ones as well. And even suggestions of a tennis relived editorship. I mean, I want to do that though, so I might buy that. and it's all going to be Pete Sampras related. So that's for the future on December the 1st. We have got a lot to get our teeth into today here on the Tennis Podcast, because for a start, the matches have been, both singles wise, have both been amazing. And really want to pick those apart, lots to discuss. And a lot of tennis news as well, because there's been Australian Open news breaking tonight that we're going to discuss. And also we're going to have round two of Matt versus me regarding the volleys of Roger Federer, with some extra input from people that Catherine Whittaker has been speaking to today. How's your day been, Catherine?
Very good.
Has it?
Yeah.
Atmos-wise? Atmos-wise, to me... I know there's nobody in the stadium, but you tell me this. All right, I'm going to ask Matt instead. Matt, even though there were no people in the stadium, to me, that match between Dominic Thiem and Rafael Nadal today, which was 7-6, 7-6, and just incredible tennis, it was one of those that reminded you that even though I missed the crowds, but actually that one didn't need a crowd. It was that good.
It gave me women's semi-final US Open vibes, when the tennis was just so good on that evening, when you had that Brady-Osaka match and that Azarenka-Serena match. I agree with you. I thought it would have been nice to have a crowd, but it didn't feel like it needed a crowd. I think maybe that's the, what is it they say, the learning that we can take from sort of not having crowds in tennis. I think really bad matches are really bad, whether there's a crowd or there's not a crowd. Really good matches are really good whatever. I think what crowds do is kind of elevate good or mediocre matches and kind of make us more engaged with them. But I think if there's a fantastic match like this one was today, you can get into it and you can feel the buzz and you can feel the electricity in a way just between the two players and from the quality of the tennis. And I was fully engaged with all 2 hours and 20 minutes of it, or however long it was. It was absolutely fantastic. It was the most invigorated I've been by tennis in several weeks, I would say.
Yeah, it was, well, 7-6, 7-6 could have gone either way. There were great opportunities for both players to wrestle the match from one another. Catherine, you are effectively our Mary Carrillo tonight, because on that women's semi-final night that Matt describes, Mary was in the stadium. She was one of the select few that had that seat overlooking the actual court and not a TV screen. You were doing that today. What did it feel like, and what was the sort of chat like amongst you and your peers while that match was going on?
Oh, probably the match of the year, quality wise. I mean, they were both pretty much 10 out of 10 for a full 2 hours and 25 minutes in terms of quality. That is so incredibly rare. I was exhilarated by it. I loved the match. I was glued to it in a way I haven't been by any match so far. My experience of watching it in the stadium is different to what you two are describing, to what you described there, Matt. I was more aware of the lack of crowds and more sad about it than I have been during any other match, actually. And I'm very pleased to hear your experience wasn't that, because it just emphasises me how different it is on the telly. And I'm, you know, obviously I'm presenting the telly, so I'm glad that that people watching on the telly are having a decent viewing experience. And look, it did not take away from my enjoyment of the tennis, but after every point, I was imagining, sort of, I could sort of hear the faint ghostly echo of the roar that there should have been. And I guess it's, I was trying to debate with myself about why it is. And, you know, I'm gazing over this stadium, and perhaps it's because probably 70% of my field of vision is occupied by empty seats. And you're not seeing that on the telly most of the time. Occasionally there's a wide shot, but mostly you're seeing the tennis and the players. And yeah, I'm looking at that too, but I can't crop out those empty seats. And I think possibly it's down to something as simple as that. So I was saddened by it as I was completely exhilarated by it. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. I think it should feel sad that there wasn't a crowd to enjoy that. It deserved a crowd. There deserved to be 17,000 people in the world that get to say for the rest of their lives that they saw that match live, because I really do think it is one of those ones that the memory will last. People remember, yeah, do you remember that Nadal team match at the O2 that year? Goodness me.
Mm. What I loved about it was, I think if you'd had a crowd, people wouldn't have necessarily been just pulling for one or the other. They would have been just glorying in the fact that they got to see it. They'd have been high-fiving each other. They'd have been turning around to each other and just saying, did you see that? And then the next one. And the players themselves were getting off on it, I felt. You know, statement tennis. I am playing my best, and have a bit of this forehand bent around you at the net for a clean winner. And then team did exactly the same back to him in the next point. I mean, it was just point and counterpoints being made all the way through it. And I think that they were pretty much playing as well as they can throughout the match. And where did it turn, Matt? Because that first set in the tiebreak, Nadal looked like he was going to win it.
Yeah, I think he was 5-2 up in the first set tiebreak. I felt good about Thiem going into that tiebreak because he's been incredible in them all season. I remember that quarterfinal he played against Nadal at the Australian Open. It was 3 tiebreaks that he won. He then won 2 more against Zverev in the Australian Open semifinals. He won all the crucial tiebreaks he played in the US Open. He has unlocked something in tiebreaks, I think, this year. I think he spoke about it during the US Open, how he's sort of taken inspiration from Djokovic in a way and decided to lock in tiebreaks and not make errors. And whatever it is that he's doing, it's working. He's a giant in those biggest moments. And this was a match which was nip and tuck the whole way. It was so close, and it was decided in those tiebreaks where Thiem was the better player. And I think, you know, Nadal has summed it up pretty well in his press conference by saying, I actually feel more like I'm going to have a good result in this tournament, even though I lost that match, because I played so well. He's not thinking just because he lost it, it's sort of ended his chances in this tournament. Quite the opposite. He was so encouraged by the level he played, and he just knows that Thiem got him in those 2 tiebreaks by raising his game. I mean, some of the forehand winners Dominic Thiem hit in that first set tiebreak, especially when he was down, were outstanding. I mean, I'm not sure there's anyone else who's got that weight of shot and can push Nadal around like Thiem can at the moment. It kind of forces you to change your entire belief system about tennis. You know, for so long it's been, if a member of the big three plays well, they will win. And we're now in a stage where Nadal is playing well against Dominic Thiem and he's not winning. And that is a credit to the way Thiem has improved and matured into this player who can go toe-to-toe with them. He's got a winning record against the big three in the last 2 years, a substantial winning record. And against those players, it's tiny moments, small margins, and Thiem is winning them. He's gutsy, he's brave, and I'm just full of admiration for his tennis. It was a joy.
I have to say, when you were describing that, that really did bring that Djokovic Thiem match back to me last year. That feeling that Djokovic has played well and has still lost, you know, and it is, you're right, that's very well put, that it shakes your foundations a little. But it's exciting as well.
It was a performance every bit as breathtaking from Thiem today as it was against Djokovic last year. And maybe this is perception rather than reality, because it kind of fits with our narrative about Thiem, but I felt less on edge about his performance, less like he was absolutely redlining it and it could crumble at any moment. I felt like there was just 0.5% extra margin to it.
Yeah.
Somehow he was just he was playing that way and yet somehow in a comfort zone.
Yeah, it's the floor, isn't it? The floor has risen in his game. And I think that part of that is just miles on the clock. But also, I think it is Grand Slam title status. He believes now his basic game, if he plays well, not out of this world, but just really well, that will be enough to live with these guys and may well beat them.
And I think he enjoys playing Nadal, I think, more so than he does Novak Djokovic. I think Djokovic can constrict him a little bit in the way he can everyone. With Nadal, he gets the kind of rallies, the shape of exchanges that he likes. And I think if you were to look at Dominic Thiem's career, so many of his best performances would have come against Nadal, I think. He's beaten him 5 seasons in a row, I want to say. He's sort of incrementally just improved and got better against Nadal. And there are lots of individual parts of his game that create this package that when he comes up against Nadal, he's a really tough opponent now for Nadal. I think I talked about that weighted shot on that forehand. His serve is unattackable on that second serve. I mean, you saw what Nadal did to Rublev's serve in the first match. He couldn't do that to Thiem. The way Thiem was hitting his backhand up the line, he said something fascinating about how he was really practicing that. And it works on a hard court, but he struggles to do it on clay against Nadal because of the topspin and it comes up higher. So therefore, he does feel like, I remember you said on Prime, Catherine, is this a closer match a better matchup for Thiem on a hard court than it is on a clay court. And I think it absolutely is because of that shot. He can't really hit that against Nadal on clay, but on a hard court he can. And it's kind of the Djokovic playbook, but Thiem style, with his one-handed backhand and his explosive power and his movement. It's a package of things that when you put them all together, it feels like he can sustain all of them against Nadal. And it's just one of my favorite matches to watch because Nadal has to kind of figure it out, and now he's the one having to adapt a little bit.
He had a really wonderful awareness in that post-match interview he did on the court of what they had produced there in terms of a tennis spectacle. I don't know whether it's the fact that he mentioned that Austria has gone into lockdown today, I think he said. So I don't know whether that was kind of weighing on his mind, but he actually gave a really quite a powerful sort of little soliloquy, really, about how he hoped that spectacle, that 2 hours and 25 minutes, had provided a bit of escapism for people, and you know, he talked about the privileged position that they're in, getting to continue to do what they love. You know, Dominic Thiem hasn't always been the most pandemic conscious guy, or certainly hasn't seemed to be necessarily over the past few months. He's not made any sort of massive faux pas, but he certainly hasn't seemed to be in the Nadal category of, you know, having this real awareness and attunement with what's going on in the world. So I found it quite moving, really, what he said after that match, and kind of putting in it. He just seemed to understand what we'd all been through emotionally watching that match and what it meant to us. I felt really kind of on a level with him.
Yeah. I think we could do a whole podcast just about highlight moments from the match, but let's just pick out two very quickly here, both of them involving tweeners. One was by Thiem, lobbed, goes back, and he plays one of the most controlled, paddled through the leg shots that I've seen. It wasn't just him flicking at the ball and blasting it as hard as he could at his opponent. He just finessed it flat as a bat over the net, onto the feet of Nadal at the net. And Nadal just half-volley dinked it over the net for a cushioned, clean winner. It was just beautiful racket control from both of them.
It was okay.
We'll get onto that. And then the next one was following a succession of saved match points by Nadal. He'd saved three match points from, I think, love 40 down, and then he got lobbed.
It was Kenin-esque, that game.
Yeah, he got lobbed, ran back, lifted a through-the-legs lob of his own, nigh on perfection, that Thiem did very well to get to and smash back. Nadal still had to have the presence of mind to hit a forehand at the feet of Thiem in order to set up a lofted half volley for Nadal to then rush forward and pass down the line with the backhand. I mean, the combinations just, and they were fairly close together in the match. And again, you're shaking your head in disbelief. We've been watching tennis all these years, and they can still make you think, have I just seen that?
Mm. Yeah, I found that game where, as you said, Nadal was love 40 down, serving to stay in the match, three match points down. It's probably the first time in the whole match someone had strung three bad points together in a row. I think he missed a backhand volley, a forehand,
and
then a smash. He completely framed it, didn't he? Mistimed it. And then he just played, I think, three perfect serves that Thiem didn't get back to get it back to deuce, and then perfect points to recover. It's kind of the tennis version of what Tiger Woods did at the weekend, getting a 10 on a par three, so having an absolute mare. And then he went and birdied five of the next six holes. And Nadal, in that moment, just pulled himself together and then played some of the best tennis he can when he absolutely needed to. And that's a quality that not many players have, I don't think. That presence of mind, that ability to put points behind him. He's extraordinary at that. And then it's kind of a testament as well then to Thiem that he didn't keep thinking about those match points, and he managed to put them behind him and play as well as he did for the rest of the match. It was a key moment, and both of them responded to it perfectly.
Mm. Yeah, Simon Briggs described it in his piece as the burly team even managing to out-muscle tennis's Mr. Universe, which I think sums it up pretty well. That shows what team has managed to achieve there. And I think it all quite early on in that first set, I just saw a look in the eye in the Dow where I thought, he really rates Dominic Thiem. He everything about Thiem he respects, the physicality, the competitiveness, the desire, and the shot making. There are not many that I think Nadal probably looks down the other end and thinks, fair play, mate. I can't really get to you, and you're a match for me. The other little note I wanted to mention was as well watching Nicolas Massou in the crowd. I say crowd, in the seats. I don't think there's a coach.
He wasn't in the crowd. He was the crowd.
He was the crowd. I don't think there's a coach that I've seen that looks like he's enjoying watching his own player more than Nicolas Massou. He looks like he's just getting off on the whole thing. He's just loving it. He's buzzing throughout the whole thing.
Thiem does have that effect, I think.
Yeah,
he's so explosive to watch. You can't be neutral, I don't think, watching Thiem. He will move you in some way or other when you're watching him.
Yeah, I do feel like if you don't like watching Dominic Thiem's tennis, then you probably don't like tennis.
Yeah. Yeah,
I feel like David's been told off for saying that in the past.
I've been told off for saying that about Shapovalov, haven't I? I get told off a lot, but I couldn't agree more with you, really. I mean, you must, what is going on? If that doesn't make you think, wow, there's something wrong, really. So anyway, that puts Dominic Thiem through. He's automatically qualified for the semi-finals now. Rafael Nadal is going to be in a battle on Thursday night, we now know, with Stefanos Tsitsipas, who has just about beaten Andrei Rublev tonight. And I did something that I very rarely do today, and that's I had a nap. And upon announcing to Matt and Catherine that I was going to go and have a nap, 1 minute later, Catherine wrote, "It's too late to have a nap." And I didn't know this rule. I mean, I'd already gone for my nap at this point, so it's 2 hours later by the time I read that. And it was lovely, by the way. But whilst napping, I mean, first of all, Catherine, why was it too late to have a nap? I mean, I feel great.
Well, my rule is sort of anything after about 6:30 and you're sort of just going to bed really early.
So how's that going to affect me tonight? Because it's 12:30
yeah,
and I feel
fantastic
right
now. Yeah. Your eyes are saying, you know, I've been up for 8 days, but I'm fine because I've had a load of Red Bull. Yeah, you're not going to sleep. So I hope it was a really good nap.
Yeah, it was great. Great.
You can edit, yeah. David. There's an idea.
No, yeah, but you've had a nap as well. So
I have.
That
true.
Don't try and get out of that.
Showing off, both of you.
So anyway, whilst napping, I came out of nap and the doubles had finished and Andrei Rublev was set down after 19 minutes. What happened in those 19 minutes?
Oh, he was really bad.
Was he? It wasn't Tsitsipas just being amazing.
I mean, Tsitsipas was good. He was as good as he needed to be. He didn't need to be very good. Am I being harsh, Matt?
No, I don't think so. I think you're being spot on. That was my reading of it. I really feared for that match in those first 19 minutes. Rublev looked out of his depth and he looked, I thought, exhausted. I mean, he's given some quotes this week saying that in Paris he was mentally exhausted and physically exhausted, and now he's really fresh. I don't really understand how that happened in the space of a week. I could understand how you were feeling better, but to go from exhausted to fresh, it feels like there wasn't enough time for that to happen.
It's what the Intercontinental O2 does to you.
So
it's not.
So I was then, you know, it's kind of down about Rublev as I was in that first set. I was so impressed by the way he managed to get back in the match. And it seemed that, I'm sure there were more complicated reasons than this to why he got back in it, but it seemed that he found his serve. I mean, in the first set, he couldn't get his serve in at all. And Tsitsipas, I've already talked about about Rublev's second serve not being particularly good. Tsitsipas was just dominating it. But then Rublev started getting that serve in, and that is plan A. That's what we talk about with Rublev. Get the serve in, dominate with the forehand. And it's a good plan A. And it started working, and it got him back in the match. And then I started fearing for Tsitsipas. And I was getting, what was it, that Federer quote he gave you in the lift? Why do I lose all the close matches? I started thinking that about Tsitsipas, because recently he's lost so many close matches. Obviously, starting with Čorić, he lost to Sinner in Rome, which was close. Roland Garros was close to Djokovic. Humbert the other week was close. He's had a really poor record in these deciding
Rublev
sets.
Rublev in that final.
Rublev in the Hamburg final. Yeah, exactly. So,
lost his last three tie breaks.
Exactly. So I started to kind of panic for him and think...
just all-round panic.
Yeah, it was just a complete reverse from the first set. And I think it's really big for him that he managed to find a way through it. I think it's... He's building his confidence back up gradually.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
And this is a block in that confidence. I think it would have been, you know, a couple of steps back if he loses another tight one. Because he didn't used to lose tight matches. This is a relatively new thing. And I think it's important that he gets back on the right track as quickly as he possibly can. And he was obviously helped by Rublev double faulting on the match point in the final set tiebreak. But then Tsitsipas played a nice point himself and managed to kind of wrestle it. He praised his own bravery in that final set. I think it's an important one for Tsitsipas.
That double fault though, Catherine, Andre Rublev had match point and double faulted. I mean, I don't want to be mean, but that's not on, is it? If you're his coach, you are fuming at him. And I'm thinking Rublev right now, he is just having nightmares as we speak. He's tossing and turning in his bed and he's dreaming about that moment that the ball hit the net on that second serve.
It was a bit of a cliche rookie error, wasn't it? It's just the sort of error that experienced players kind of don't make. And I spent that first set sort of condemning him as a junior playing in the senior league. You know, he really looked like not a fully formed top tennis player. What were you and what were you and Math comparing him to on the Kyrgyoptimists chat, which definitely needs a rebrand?
Math came up with the brilliant line that he looked like a T20 player drafted into the test team.
And Matt said, oh God, he's Jason Roy.
Yes, who is a brilliant white ball cricketer. And then as soon as he has to play with a red ball, he can't score any runs at all. And kind of felt like Rublev has these occasional flashes of brilliance and then just generally looked out of his depth against these better players. So it is a credit to him that he turned it around. He turned it around very subtly. It was a surprise when he won the second set. I almost felt like the person in charge of the fake crowd noise was surprised, because I'm not sure there was any when he won the second set. It just sort of suddenly happened.
Just a couple of notes of clarification. Math is Catherine's brother. He's a massive Kyrgyoptimist, and they're talking about T20 and Test cricket here, aren't they? And eventually the name David Warner came up from Math as an alternative. Now, what does that mean? I don't know really who David Warner is.
He's an Australian who was a white ball cricketer, so T20, 50 overs, who went into the test team and has been brilliant in test cricket. So Rublev did a full transformation in the course of a match.
Right.
I do just... Maybe I'm looking too much into the kind of Tsitsipas sort of mental woes here, but it's kind of the domino effect of being somebody that is struggling mentally with blowing leads. Rublev will have been aware of that. You know, I think if you lose an opening set against Djokovic 6-1 and you're Andre Rublev, you're probably not thinking, oh, I've still got a chance here. But I think just at the moment, possibly this effect is lessening with every match like today that Tsitsipas wins. Just at the moment, Tsitsipas, you know, races into a lead, and still I think the opponent's thinking, I could still get him on the ropes here. You know, there's a weakness to be poured at.
I also think it's quite a big moment for Rublev.
Just how big a deal it was for him to win today, Tsitsipas.
Coming back for Rublev, making it a fight. I mean, I think that's really important, because he was on the verge of... He'd lost three straight sets in this tournament on his debut and was looking completely out of his depth, and yet he made that interesting, competitive, and arguably should have ended up winning it. So, you know, if you're a glasses-half-full type, you've got to take some positivity from that, I would have thought.
And I think that point Catherine made about him knowing Tsitsipas is Rublev's whole point of being at this tournament. He says to get more experience. I hadn't realised how relatively few times he's played all the top players, because so much of his success has been at the 250s and the 500s. He just hasn't really run into them that much. He's only played Federer once in his career. He's played Nadal twice now, and he's never played Djokovic. And for someone to be at the year-end finals with that record, those few matches against the players who are always in the latter stages of tournaments, just shows that he does need experience. And I think he's got experience against Tsitsipas. He feels more comfortable in that matchup. He had a terrible start, but he kind of knew there was a route back in. And perhaps when he can start playing these top players more, he'll be... I mean, it could go the other way. He could build up a load of baggage and sort of... There could be the opposite effect. But I think what he's hoping for is that the more he plays them, the more comfortable he'll feel playing them. And just he'll feel like he belongs, I think, more. And this, I suppose what you're saying, David, is this comeback, or not quite comeback, will kind of contribute to that feeling of belonging, I think, as well, in this tournament.
Yeah, I think so. He now faces a dead rubber, basically, against Dominic Thiem on Thursday afternoon, and it's the Tsitsipas-Nadal blockbuster in the evening session on Thursday. Doubles today, Wesley Kulhoff and Nikola Mektic won against Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury. Very close first set, 7-6. Then a very one-sided second, 6-love.
Unexpected Yulia Gerges in Wesley Kulhoff packing area.
Oh, really?
Really?
That's interesting.
Yes. Oh. Julia Gerges and Wesley Kuhlhoff seem to be a thing.
Oh, she's recently retired, isn't she?
Yes.
At the end of this year. And so, yeah, in attendance. I didn't know that. That might have been during one of my naps. Kevin Kravitz, I'm not very experienced at napping. I keep doing it at the wrong times. Kevin Kravitz and Andreas Mies won against Lucas Kubot and Marcella Mello. 6-2, 7-6 is the other one.
So Kravitz and Mies, it's a straight shootout with Salisbury and Ram.
Oh, is it? That's good.
For the second qualification spot in that group, Kubot and Mello are out.
I mean, it's always a bit of a blow when you've got to put up with these dead rubbers, but at the same time, I can't stand these matches where you're trying to do maths in your head about who goes through and whatever. But I mean, that, you know, we're going to have at least two out of four matches on Thursday will be fantastic then, as sort of eliminators, won't they? So we'll look forward to those. You had today, Catherine, in the Prime Video studio, you had Tim Henman with you, and there was a really interesting discussion about Andy Murray. I thought I was really fascinated to hear the views being put forward, and one of them in particular that I found really interesting, that when talking about his the potential that remains in Murray's career, how hard he's working, and Murray himself, there were clips of him talking about how he still thinks he can get even stronger at this stage of his career. And Henman said, was just wondering whether that is really what you want as a tennis player, to be more muscular potentially, or carrying too much weight in this era. I found all that very interesting. He's he ended up concluding, Henman, that he thinks Murray could, if he gets fit. I think you asked him if he doesn't have any more injury setbacks, what is the potential for the remainder of Murray's career? And I think Henman said that he could win tournaments on tour, but slams would likely be beyond him.
Yes, I think he sort of pointed to Antwerp last year as a sort of what we have kind of the empirical evidence of being a peak post resurfacing Andy Murray. And, you know, he required a pretty high level to win that Antwerp title. It was a really high-quality final against Stan Wawrinka. He thought the rigours of five-set tennis and the recovery required in five-set tennis tournaments was potentially a bridge too far. I asked Daniela the same question, and she put it in terms of ranking rather than tournaments, and she thought top 10 was achievable.
Wow.
Daniela is a kind of a big believer in mind over matter, and I know she is in awe of the mind of Andy Murray and the will of Andy Murray, and she kind of thinks, I think she's wary of discounting him from doing anything. But she certainly is an optimist where he's concerned.
Mm. And just to say, Daniela was the person who I found to be most optimistic about Victoria Azarenka's chances of any kind of comeback. I had completely written her off, really, as a relevant force in the game. And I know Hantikova said earlier this year that she thought Azarenka could come back and compete again, and she certainly has been doing that in the last few months. So let's hope that Hantikova's crystal ball is working with Murray in the same way it is with Azarenka.
Hmm. You had more chats with Tim Henman today, Catherine, and put to him the words that Matt and I had on last night's podcast about the relative volleying skills of Roger Federer and Tim Henman's assertion on air that they were okay. So what happened?
On air or off air?
Well, you tell me. What happened today?
Well, he strolled into the green room while I was in the hair and makeup chair, and Greg was in there and Daniela was in there. It was a big room. We're all socially distanced. And I said, "Oh, hello, Tim. You caused an argument on the podcast last night." And he said, "Oh, yeah, about what?" And I said, "About your assertion that Federer's volleys are okay." I said, "Settle an argument. Were you joking? Were you being playful with your choice of words?" And he said, "No, absolutely not. He wasn't being playful. He stood by it." He said, "In 1998, he said that most of the top 30 players in the world would have had better volleys than Roger Federer." I then put to him Matt's point about serving and volleying his way to a Wimbledon title in 2003, and he did say, "That's a good point," and he chewed on it a bit, and he it did seem to sort of impact his thinking a little bit, but then he's stuck to his guns. He thinks Federer's volleys are okay.
So, Matt, pretty much what I thought then.
I mean, I must say, I thought when he was sort of listing all these players that he thought were great volleyers, he was having to debate whether they were better volleyers than Federer, quite a lot of them. And I thought, in a way, that kind of proved that Federer's volleys are better than okay. If he was having to have a debate in his mind about whether Federer's a better volleyer than a Krajicek, for example, I think was one of the players, I think that all points to my point.
He said Sampras was a good volleyer and Rafter was a great volleyer.
I mean, we're into semantics.
So if Sampras
now,
is only good, maybe okay is more than okay. I don't know.
Well,
okay doesn't mean the same thing to everyone. I mean, just when you think it's the most universal word in any language, maybe we're all interpreting it differently. I don't know. I mean, Daniela, when I raised the debate again on air, Daniela said, "Blimey, if you think Federer's volleys are only okay, then I'm never volleying again, ever." yeah, I don't know. Greg was slightly more defensive of Federer's volleying skills. But, yeah, stuck to his guns.
Well, well done on taking it up, Catherine. It's very interesting.
It's great work. We'll have to ask Federer, how would you describe your volleys? Might just ask him that in a press conference
one
day.
I think it would be a really interesting discussion.
Rate your volleys out of 10.
Well, we should also ask Pat Rafter and Stefan Edberg what they think of Roger Federer's volleys. I'd be very interested to know.
I said if Edberg's a 10 out of 10, if we're taking him as the gold standard, what's Federer? And I think he said a 6.
Or a 6.5 or something.
I thought he said Federer's volleys compared to Federer were a 6.5. They were
other areas of his game.
Of his game.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I thought he had Federer down at about 5 compared to
Edberg.
And then you asked him about Zverev. You know, if Federer's a 5, where's Zverev? And he said, what, a 3 or a 2?
Yeah, I mean, relatively speaking, I think that does sound about right.
Well, if Federer's a 5, I mean, most people are a 2. There's no shame in being a 2 if Federer's a 5.
No.
It's not a 2 I have a problem with.
I'll get you watching some Stefan Edberg when we do Tennis Relived next year. And
nobody is doubting the prowess of Stefan Edberg's volleys here, David. None of this diminishes that.
No, I'm just so that you can enjoy it, because it is just... amazing experience to watch him do what he did, because there's so much he didn't have in his game, but serving and volleying was just I loved
it. You and Tim need to get a room and talk about Stefan Edberg all night.
Quite happy to. Right. Well, by the way, I remember seeing Stefan Edberg carve up Henman. I stayed up all night to watch the US Open, I think, in about 1996, and I was convinced that Henman could take him. And I was wrong. So anyway.
That was in the early Henman days.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was right at the beginning. Yeah, he got to about the fourth round, something like that. He did well at the US Open. But Edberg was just the master at that particular game. So, well, good detective work, Catherine. That was fantastic. Very interesting. We've had some news to finish the show on. We've had some news tonight from Australia that a lot of the plans that they'd had in place that we understood them to be from the interviews that Craig Tiley, the tournament director, had done, all the idea was that players would come in mid-December, do their 2 weeks of quarantine, play all of the pre-Australian Open tournaments in Melbourne to reduce travel and potential spreading of the virus. And that has, we've been told tonight in reporting by a Tennis Channel initially, that is not going to be viable, that players are not going to be allowed to come into the country as things stand in December at all. And the first day that they will be allowed to set foot in the country is the 1st of January, which, if they are required to do 2 weeks quarantine at that point, would take them up to about 3 or 4 days before the Australian Open is due to begin, which is hardly ideal, at the very least, and potentially, you know, threatens the entire Australian tennis summer. Certainly those preview or those run-up tournaments that that they would hope to run, whether the ATP Cup or some of the other events that they might bring over from Brisbane and Adelaide and Sydney. We don't know officially where Tennis Australia stand on this at the moment. We've only heard this news in the last few hours, and it does follow comments from the Premier of Victoria saying that it's absolutely not a done deal that players can come in December, you know, because of the logistical issues of bringing all these people in, and they've spent such a long time in lockdown getting rid of the virus or dampening it down to the fact that they've had apparently zero cases over the last couple of weeks, new cases. So we don't really know where we stand. I think what I kind of expect they may end up doing if this continues and that players are not allowed to come in until the end of December or the first week in January is to try to coincide the 2 weeks of quarantine with those tournaments and be able to get permission for players to practice and play competitively, I would imagine in some sort of bubble, whilst effectively quarantining. And therefore that would make it doable for them not only to run additional tournaments but also to play the Australian Open. But Catherine, this is just generally, this is a pretty alarming state of affairs, isn't it, given that it's not that far away now?
No, I mean, we're talking about players would have been booked and planning to travel in less than a month's time to Australia, significantly less than a month's time in some players' cases. And It's particularly irksome, I think, because the tennis world, or certainly I thought, okay, I mean, the barriers to entry to Australia and the price of entry is incredibly high. But once there, once the tennis world has got there and passed through those barriers, it's a kind of safe haven for tennis to exist for a while and flourish for a while. So for that to be thrown into some uncertainty is quite discombobulating, really. And I can only imagine how the players and the tours feel about it. I completely respect the position of the Australian government, absolutely. I mean, we are in a glass house in terms of, you know, criticising the likes of Australia's approach to risk-averse approach to COVID-19, absolutely. But yeah, the timing of it is very disconcerting, absolutely.
Yeah, it's something it keeps coming back to me when we were having the events after the US Open, Rome and Roland Garros, and a couple of times Matt just mentioned, I'm watching this and I'm still wondering whether it really is right, you know, to see all this international travel when this is going on. It just, it's hard to put the two together, as much as we love the sport and want it to be able to be viable at the moment. Just as a final point on tonight's tennis podcast, we've had a tweet come through tonight from Simon Briggs, our esteemed Telegraph tennis correspondent, who's written the following: just in case there wasn't enough tennis news tonight, I'm hearing that Novak Djokovic and Vasek Pospisil, who resigned from the ATP Player Council in August under duress from fellow members in order to launch the PTPA, are now applying to rejoin the Player Council. It doesn't sound like they made a lot of progress with recruitment after the tennis court picture at the US Open. Votes must be in by the end of December, and the new council starts on January the 1st. Now, currently on the council is Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Andy Murray, at least temporarily, is on it. John Millman, Felix Auger-Aliassime, I seem to remember as well, were recent additions. But blimey, that's a bit of a turn-up if that's the case, isn't it?
Yeah, this feels ripe for a how it started, how it's going meme, doesn't it?
Sure does.
I know what the how it started picture would be. Answers on a postcard for the how it's going. Yeah, I mean, it's a gutsy move to, if this is accurate, and I very much trust Simon Briggs, a gutsy move to put yourself forward again for the Player Council. That's baller.
I mean, I dare say there's a fair bit of support, at least from those players that were on the court with him, believing in Djokovic and Pospisil as player leaders. But yeah, if they are planning to do that, how they package that back to those players and explain to them why they're doing that is going to be very, very interesting. So we'll await more information when it is available. But Catherine, get to bed. Matt, you and me need to have a discussion about who's editing this thing. Have we got any shout-outs?
We do, yes. For Tamara.
Oh, Tamara. Hello, thanks Tamara. So much. Hello.
Is she like Prince?
On my
no
list,
further names.
Yes.
Okay. Hello, Tamara. It's could good to be like Prince.
Could be Tamara Glennie.
I was thinking Tamara Glennie, but what if it's not Tamara Glennie?
Who once got, I think, her daughter or a granddaughter to do the most wonderful intro for us.
That's great. Yeah. Hello to all Tamaras.
Yes.
That support the tennis podcast.
Cover the base.
The rest of you can... Matt, what else we got?
Move on, Matt. Next.
Next is Rodolphe Brum.
Rudolph.
Great name.
Awesome. Thanks so much for your support.
Good
time of year to be called Rudolph. Not Rudolph. Okay.
No, maybe I said Rodolphe.
Rodolphe.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Rodolphe. We're not
also
too
great.
Good at the names. You know, we're trying, though. We're trying.
And to Brangle Hunning.
Oh,
now,
wow.
That is a name. Oh, that's top five names. Brangle. Awesome.
A little bit like Madison Brangle. But
yeah,
not.
A little bit.
Better as a first name, though, isn't it?
This section of the show is just Catherine reviews your name. Would you like to pay?
We need a jingle.
Would you like to pay to next year have the privilege of Catherine reviewing your name on the podcast?
And from December the 1st, you'll get your chance.
And if you'd like, lucky listeners.
If you would like to sign up for a reminder of the fact that you can pay to have us dissect your name and also support the tennis podcast to be produced for another year, we have a link in our show notes on your phone right now. Just scroll down, stick your email in, and we'll send you one email to remind you on December the 1st. You can be at the front of the queue for any of the reward categories that you may be interested in. Thanks ever so much for listening to us tonight. Hope you've enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun talking tennis and a couple of great matches, bit of news, and yeah, we'll be back to do it all again tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.